Assessing the race for the White House. The first debates between the Democratic candidates for the White House are now in the history books. After all, they happened ages ago, last week. In the days since, candidates have been busy explaining and clarifying their comments, and they've been fundraising. Yesterday, the second quarter closed, and already some of the candidates are boasting about big boosts to their war chests. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Have you been following the race for the White House? Did last week's debates change your opinion about any of the candidates? What do you think really matters to voters this time around? We have two illustrious guests to analyze where we are: Tony Corrado of Colby College and Gene Cummings of The Wall Street Journal. And we're eager to hear from you. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. There are only 218 days until voters in Iowa cast the first ballots in the 2020 presidential campaign. Today, we're going to check in on the race for the White House. Joining us from Washington, D.C., Gene Cummings, The Wall Street Journal's Deputy Bureau Chief for Bureau-Wide Operations, Special Projects, and New Initiatives. You probably recognize her from her many appearances on PBS's Washington Week and other national programs. Here in the studio with me, Tony Corrado, a professor of government at Colby College and widely regarded as one of the nation's leading experts on political finance. As always, we want to hear from you. Which issues matter most to you when thinking about the presidential candidates and the issues they support or oppose? Or is it really not about issues? Is it about something else? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. I don't know about you, but everyone I know has been talking about the debates. Here we are. It's sort of the Monday after. We'll do some Monday afternoon quarterbacking here. Tony Corrado, we had two debates last week. The financial quarter closed at midnight last night. What are you thinking on this Monday?
Well, what I'm thinking is that we're starting to see the candidates separate themselves out and voters starting to get some initial look at these candidates. For many, the debate was the first time that they had a chance to see the candidates, hear what they had to say. And with the new financial numbers coming out soon, I think we'll start to see that there's some separation, that it's not going to be the kind of race where it's just a Joe Biden versus Bernie Sanders, that there are six or seven candidates who are now emerging. There's then a middling group of three or four other candidates who are starting to get some notice, so that we're going to see a number of these candidates campaigning for some time throughout this year.
Do you feel as though there were any surprises last week?
I felt that there were a couple of surprises, really. The first was I thought that Elizabeth Warren did very well. I think that she benefited from not being on the debate with Joe Biden, so that she basically focused on her plans, what she wanted to do, her ideas, which is something I think that voters wanted to hear about. And I also was surprised by how well Kamala Harris did in terms of capturing some public attention and how well-spoken Pete Buttigieg was in the debate. Also, clearly, Julian Castro, who is someone I think most voters were not familiar with at all, was able to show that he has some interesting ideas, particularly on the border, that attracted some attention. So it was an interesting two nights for the Democrats.
All right. Well, I want to make a technical note here. We're having a little trouble getting Gene Cummings on the line. I see that she keeps trying to connect with us, and we'll ask her those same questions when we do finally get her on the air with us. But we're going to move on. It seems to me, Tony Corrado, that the central debate right now in the Democratic Party is between, are we going to focus on inspiring new voters, young people, people who didn't vote in the last election, or are we going to focus on not scaring those swing voters that seem to have determined the last few elections? Am I right? Does this seem to be the debate within the Democratic Party?
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to put it. What we're seeing in the Democratic Party now is everyone agrees that we need to beat Donald Trump. Everyone agrees that Trump's policies aren't good for America. The problem is the Democrats are split on how do you go about achieving that goal, in large part because you have a bloc within the Democratic Party that believes the key to victory is to rebuild the Obama coalition and expand on it. So focus on those voters who voted for Obama and then voted for Trump. Focus on Midwestern voters, particularly non-college educated white males who are some of the voters that they lost to Donald Trump, and take that kind of pragmatic approach to victory. Those who focus on past elections tend to look at that as the strategy. Others who look more ahead think that the key is to build a new progressive coalition on top of the old Democratic Party coalition and to really focus on young voters, women, and minorities and expand their participation. They look at the 2018 midterm and they say what we need is this surge of young voters and women and this new enthusiasm in the party to build a new progressive coalition. That's the way to win in the future. And right now the party is pretty much divided in terms of which approach would be the best. In fact, if you look, there is generally a divide where about 48% of Democrats are now describing themselves as liberal, 48% are describing themselves as moderate or conservative. And there's a big difference in terms of a generation gap, in terms of those who are over the age of 49, much more supportive of Joe Biden and the kind of traditional approach. Those who are under the age of 49, much more open to a more progressive view and looking at something like building a new party coalition.
So where are the voters? What do we know about who actually will vote, both in the primaries and in the general election?
Well, in the primaries, what you're going to have is a different electorate than the general election, and that's one of the problems that these parties always have when they're in these nomination campaigns. The electorate that's going to vote in the Democratic primary is going to be much more liberal and progressive than the general electorate. It's going to skew much more towards self-identified Democrats rather than having a large independent component. And for the most part, we'll probably see much more influence by younger voters and women in particular in some of these selected state primaries. The other thing that you tend to see on the Democratic side is a great emphasis on minority voters because South Carolina, Texas, some of these states that vote early are very heavy in terms of their minority constituency in the Democratic Party. So that you tend to have candidates who are appealing to a different electorate than they're going to see when they come to the general election.
One of the things I've learned after years of interviewing political science professors that often these presidential races are decided not only in a very small number of swing states, but a very small number of counties within those swing states. And it begs the question, is that changing? And if so, how many actual undecided voters are left to compete for?
Well, generally, it's the case if you look in recent elections, you know, the two parties have become so polarized, so distinct. And we're seeing that again in this election cycle, where on the Democratic Party side, there's much more interest in giving government the power to address the problems they see, whereas in the Republican Party, you're seeing much more emphasis on minimizing the role of government and leaving it to the private sector. That most voters tend to fairly well divide Democrat or Republican, and it leaves a very small percentage of the electorate, you know, less than 10%, that truly is going to go one way or the other. And it's that 4 or 5% shift that determines presidential races. So one of the issues that is now facing the Democrats is, do we focus on those types of voters and try to win back states like Wisconsin and Michigan that we traditionally won, or do we try to expand the electorate and look at states like North Carolina and Virginia and Texas and Arizona, where demographics show growing minority populations and large number of students, and mobilizing them who have traditionally been very low turnout voters? So there's still a small number of swing states, but the strategy is more, do you try to expand and include more, or do you try to micro-target on particular voters in a few key swing states?
So am I being a good student here? The swing states, Wisconsin and Michigan, their demographics are changing And then states that didn't used to be swing states are becoming swing states because of students and immigrants.
Yes, and just, you know, shifts in the population. I mean, we've seen over the course of recent presidential elections, for example, places like Nevada, places like Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, that suddenly are starting to get more attention because of their changing demographics. Texas is really the big prize in this regard, where there is a debate as to whether the changing composition of Texas, which is not only in terms of more of a minority population, but there's been a large influx of young people into Texas because of the growing technology boom around the major cities in Texas. That is 2020 going to be a year where the Democrats can win Texas, or is that not going to occur until 2024? Much of the focus on the Beto O'Rourke race against Ted Cruz in the Senate was focused on this very issue of showing how Texas is now becoming much more competitive. And that's something that's certainly in the minds of all of these candidates.
Well, you know, we're using some shorthand here. When we talk about minority voters, when we talk about young people, is that indeed good for Democrats? Is it right to assume that the younger the demographic is, the more likely that person is to vote for, that group is to vote Democratic?
Oh, it's clearly the case that particularly amongst younger voters now, and this really is not limited to, you know, white, black, Latino, younger voters are much more progressive than older voters. You know, and as you start to look at voters, particularly under the age of 29, what you see is they're a very different generation. You know, they're very concerned about a lot of the issues that have not gained a lot of attention in the past. There's much greater concern with issues of climate change, issues about student debt, issues related to immigration, issues related to racial justice that are really more the focal point of their thinking. You know, this is a generation that has, you know, very different attitudes on everything from great gay rights to the legalization of marijuana. And therefore, they have a much greater emphasis, particularly on economic inequality.
But isn't it the case that young people don't vote? People under 29 may feel these ways and tell pollsters these things, but that their numbers are pretty abysmal when it comes to the voting booth.
Traditionally, this has been in some ways the problem that Democrats face, that, you know, younger voters, because they have such lower turnout rates, have never really kind of achieved the promise that the Democrats hoped for them. The reason why the thinking is different now is because they tend to see Donald Trump as the great polarizer and motivator, that given the concern about Trump and his policies, those in the party who believe that, you know, greater turnout amongst younger voters is one of the keys to victory see their opposition to Trump as mobilizing them in ways that wasn't the case in the past. And that this would, for example, address the concern the party had with their great enthusiasm for Bernie Sanders last time, but they were much less enthusiastic about Hillary Clinton in the general election. And those who believe in the more traditional Democratic strategy point to that and say, well, this is the concern we have, that if we orient more towards these progressive issues, we're likely not to get the turnout we need in the general election. So we're better off looking at our more traditional approach. And that's really the debate that will take place now until the Democrats eventually come up with a nominee.
We're speaking with Colby College professor and political scientist Tony Corrado on Maine Calling today, talking about the race for the White House. We are expecting to be joined by The Wall Street Journal's Gene Cummings, but are having technical issues. Those technical issues have taken out our phone. So if you'd like to join the conversation, we ask you to send in questions on email, talk@mainepublic.org. Again, talk@mainepublic.org, and keep it brief. Tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We will let you know when the phones get back. Really eager to have Gene Cummings join us and weigh in. But Tony, you're an expert on political finance. Several of the candidates have pledged not to take PAC money, Political Action Committee money. I have a couple questions about that. One, is that really meaningful when you have all these other organizations that will be doing fundraising on, and I'm putting air quotes here, on behalf of the candidates? And second of all, do voters even care?
Voters care a lot about the role of money in elections. And over time, as we've now seen larger and larger amounts being funneled into elections, there's greater and greater concern about the effect, particularly of corporate money and business money in the political process. Now, this has led a number of candidates to take the position that they are not going to accept corporate PAC money or even contributions from lobbyists, which in the context of a presidential race, especially a Democratic presidential race, is not that meaningful in terms of the practical aspect of raising money. Because last time around, for example, there was only $300,000 that was given to Democrats from corporate PACs. Generally, PACs don't give to presidential candidates, and corporate PACs certainly don't give to Democratic presidential candidates. So it's more a symbolic statement of principle than actually an effect in terms of the fundraising. I think that what's been more important this time around is the emphasis the candidates are trying to place on grassroots fundraising. Usually at this time in a presidential race, we'll be hearing a lot from the candidates about how much money they raised. And if you looked at the front runners, it was generally the rule that more than half of their money would come from large contributions of $1,000 or more. You know, it was busy running from fundraiser to fundraiser around the apartment penthouses of Manhattan or through the restaurants of San Francisco to collect big money, often having bundlers, people who fundraise, putting together $100,000 for them. That was the way you got ahead. That was always George Bush's strategy, for example. What you see now is the exact reverse of that. What you see are candidates now vying to be the one who has the most donors, the one who follows and emulates Bernie Sanders in 2016. Sanders' approach really did revolutionize fundraising in the Democratic Party. His emphasis on small donors, his emphasis on grassroots fundraising, combined with the fact that now it is so easy for anyone just from their phone to make a contribution to a candidate, shows you how different it is now, where most of these Democrats are raising most of their money from small donors who give less than $100. And what you see more and more now are the metrics of fundraising aren't just here's how much I have raised, which is still important, but you see now, you know, Kamala Harris putting out press releases, we raised $2 million in the 24 hours after the debate. You know, they're all trying to show the outpouring of grassroots support and how many donors they have. That's really become important to them.
All right. Well, we are talking about the race for the White House. Again, phones are down for the time being. We're working on fixing that. So if you'd like to participate, please do. Our email address, talk@mainpublic.org, tweet @MainCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine Masonic Charitable Foundation, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine. Maine Senior Guide, an online resource of services and information for older Mainers and their families. More at maineseniorguide.com. And Fallbrook Woods, a Maine-owned assisted living community in Portland, supporting the unique needs and individual styles of those with memory impairment. Fallbrookwoods.com.
On the next Fresh Air, the human toll of moderating Facebook's content. We talk with journalist Casey Newton about the people who work for outside contractors monitoring texts or images of hate, murder, child exploitation, animal abuse, and more. Many workers are traumatized. One contractor died. Newton also will tell us what Facebook is doing about it. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. You are invited to join the Maine Public News Department for a community discussion around Maine Public's Deep Dive series on child care on Monday evening, July 8th, that's next Monday, starting at 5:30 at the Rhines Auditorium at the Portland Public Library. Hosted by Maine Public's Patty White, Maine Public's reporters will discuss what was learned and what are next steps surrounding the issues that were touched on. They'll also be there to hear from you and listen to your comments and field any questions you might have. Hope to see you there.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, The Race for the White House. Joining us for this conversation, Tony Corrado, a professor of government at Colby College, and hopefully soon we'll be joined by Gene Cummings, Wall Street Journal's deputy bureau chief for Bureau-Wide Operations in Washington, D.C. We invite you to join the conversation, but not by phone because of those technical issues. Please send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. And I'll start with a tweet. This is from Nissa. She says, I really hope today's Maine Calling talks about the Republican primary challenge from Governor Bill Weld and not just the Democratic side of the ticket. Coverage has been incredibly one-sided. So I'm glad you brought this up, Nissa, and I did indeed intend to talk about it. Tony Corrado, there were at some point in the past a lot of Republicans who were never Trumpers. Are we still going to see more emerge to challenge him, or is Governor Weld going to be his only challenger?
You know, the Republican side is very interesting, and I think that I've been surprised by the fact that there's been so little coverage of Governor Weld, in large part because it's not only the case that you have within the party, you know, some Republicans who had not supported Trump, but also what you find is that there is a share of Republicans who are in a position where they disapprove of Trump's performance. They don't like his behavior as president, even though many of them share some of his policy views. So that there's this problem within the Republican Party of some Republicans who don't really care for the president's behavior, but they tend to support the policies that he supports, which seems to provide an opportunity for someone to come in and say, I kind of support these policies, but, you know, I will act more presidentially, or at least get some notice for what he's doing on the campaign trail. But that hasn't been the case, I think, in part because there are so many Democratic candidates running that takes up a lot of the coverage. And there are so many events going on, whether it's the investigations on Capitol Hill or the China trade agreement or the foreign policy developments, that, you know, you just tend to get squeezed out of the news cycle. And I think that, you know, Governor Weld hasn't really, been saying much or been doing much on the campaign trail to try to break into all of that news coverage, at least not so far. But it's certainly the case that one of the reasons why they've been giving less coverage, or at least why the Trump administration has been somewhat concerned about people like Weld, is that they have been working very hard on the inside to make sure that the Trump campaign is going to have control of the Republican National Committee, control of these state party primaries and caucuses. They've done a lot of work to elect their supporters in some of these state parties in order to try to block off the prospect of someone mounting a serious challenge.
Well, let me ask you about the strength of Weld's candidacy. What do you see there?
It's very difficult, particularly because you have a president who's, you know, at the head right now of a very good economy. And generally, it's the case that there isn't one big cutting issue like economic decline or like some major foreign policy problems that are leading people to look elsewhere at this point. So that the one negative that he has is the fact that his personal behavior tends to turn off some Republicans. But that's not really enough to mount, you know, a major challenge, as we saw, say, against Jimmy Carter in 1980. It's always very difficult to take on an incumbent president because they have most of the cards, and you really need some help by some development in the real world to help spur that type of a candidacy.
We have an email from Peggy. Few of the candidates have mentioned climate change. The irony is that nothing else matters, not health care, not gun control, not abortion, if we don't have a livable planet. Polls say we want progress on climate change, but no one's prepared to pay for it. The first candidate to mention, say, a 20-cent tax on a gallon of gas will immediately become unelectable. How do we get past this?
I was surprised that there was so little discussion of climate change in the debates, because it's clearly the case that a number of the candidates have focused on climate change, and it's clearly the case that all of the candidates generally agree that something has to be done to start to address the environmental challenges that we face. In fact, I was looking at an analysis of all the tweets that candidates have sent out, over 24,000 tweets already.
Oh, my.
Just the other day, and I was surprised at how high the environment was on that list. It was basically, you know, economic inequality, jobs, health care, and the environment. But I think that part of the reason why we didn't hear a lot about it in the debates was because the moderators just didn't focus on that issue and ask them questions about it. Because it's clearly the case on the campaign trail, we're getting more discussion about climate change than we've ever seen before. And we have a range of candidates talking about climate issues. In fact, we have Governor Inslee, who's made climate change the sole issue of his campaign to try to encourage that debate, and has actually asked the Democratic National Committee if they could have one debate just focused on climate change, which the party has been resistant so far. But it's something we're going to hear more about as the campaign progresses, I'm sure. Because what's clear is that amongst Democratic voters, particularly Democratic primary voters, particularly the younger voters that we talked about earlier in the show, this is a pressing issue that they want to see specific plans from the candidates on.
Peggy, thank you so much for that email. One of the topics that was not discussed in the debates is climate change. But Tony Corrado, there are others that were not discussed in the debates. And one of the big ones was foreign policy, especially considering where we are in this moment in human history.
Yeah, it was remarkable to me that in two nights, 4 hours of debate and all the questions, there wasn't really much emphasis on foreign policy. Maybe we'll see that in the debates that come up at the end of this month. But if you think about the fact that right now we are in the midst of this debate over trade with China, which traditionally has been a big concern for the Democratic Party, particularly, the Labor Coalition and the traditional Democratic Party. The fact that we're in the midst of, trying to settle on this new trade agreement between the United States, Mexico, and Canada, the developments in Syria, the lack of progress in North Korea, the decision to pull out of the Iran nuclear deal, one would think that, foreign policy would be at the forefront of a lot of the thinking. I think so far, one of the things we've seen is that some of the candidates like Tulsi Gabbard and others have made foreign policy a concern and have raised questions about the use of the military. But for the most part, at least early on, candidates are focusing on the issues that are most on voters' minds, and that tends to be jobs, economic inequality, health care, immigration. But I'm sure that we'll hear and have to hear more from the Democrats, because this is certainly an area where there's good reason to question some of the president's decision-making and whether or not we have a coherent foreign policy at this point.
Isn't the conventional wisdom that voters vote, though, with pocketbook issues, and maybe this is why we're ignoring the foreign policy issues?
That is the conventional wisdom. The conventional wisdom is that generally, voters are going to focus on domestic issues and the economy most of all, and foreign policy tends to be a voting issue for the public when there's some crisis at hand. And that generally it tends to favor the incumbent because generally the president is the one who's seen in charge of the crisis. But I think that, we're seeing, again, shifting attitudes on some of this in large part because, and it's related to Peggy's point about climate change, not only climate change, but globalization is seen as, part of our world now, and particularly amongst progressive voters. This is seen as an issue that has effect both in terms of domestic policy and foreign policy, and therefore something I expect we'll be hearing more about.
All right. Well, as we've mentioned, we are having technical issues. We're not able to take your calls right now, but we'd love to hear from you. We'd love to know what you think about the race for the White House at this point. Here we are, July 1st, 2019. You can send an email, a brief email, to talk@mainpublic.org. You can post to our Facebook page, or you can tweet at Maine Calling. We'll go to a Facebook message from Bob. For Maine, with the new Democratic primary, will it use the ranked choice voting process for presidential candidates? I understand that it is a closed primary, so I will have to move again from my default independent status. And is there home for the constitutional amendment to fix RCV in time for state candidates 2020?
Well, I don't think there's time to fix it in terms of 2020, particularly because any of the Democratic primary systems also have to be approved by the Democratic National Committee in order to be recognized as seating the delegates from Maine. But I do think it's the case that moving towards primaries rather than caucuses is very healthy because it ensures much broader participation. It makes it much easier for individuals to cast their ballot, and it tends to broaden out those who tend to vote. But as Bob notes, the issue is whether you have a closed primary or an open primary. And my understanding is that in Maine, they're looking at closed primaries so that independents...
So you have to be a Democrat to vote in the Democratic primary or Republican to vote in the Republican or registered as one.
Yes, you'd have to be a registered Democrat to vote in the Democratic primary, a registered Republican to vote in the Republican primary, which kind of leaves independent voters out.
Which are the majority in Maine.
And are very important because they tend to vote differently from the more traditional registered Democrats or Republicans that tend to turn out. And if you want to see how that works, you can look at the Democratic primaries last time. Where there were open Democratic primaries, particularly primaries where they allowed independents to vote in the Democratic primary, that's where Bernie Sanders did the best. Those were the states where Sanders did well because he could bring in a lot of these independent voters or voters who had been traditionally discouraged by the Democratic offerings and therefore were mobilized to turn out, whereas Hillary Clinton and more established Democrats tend to do much better in closed primaries. So that who is allowed to participate in a party's primary does have a meaningful effect. It was the same thing on the Republican side last time. If you look, Donald Trump did much better where there were open primaries than he did in the Republican primaries that were closed.
So do you believe that in states that open parties are better for the political parties in the long run, in the general election? They're more likely to choose a candidate with open primary system who is has better chance of winning the overall race, the general election.
Yeah, I tend to think it's better for the parties to have open primaries because if they offer candidates who have broad appeal to voters, it gives them the ability to attract people into their party rather than just sticking with the base that they have now. And I also think that it's the case that if you have more open primaries, you tend to get a better measure of which candidates have some appeal to the independents during the primary process.
We have an email from Lenny. I'm an active Democrat locally and nationally. Harris lost my respect. I'd like to see focus on current issues, not the past. Castro gained it along with Buttigieg. I'm concerned about the Senate since McConnell will block the progress on Democrats' initiatives. Thanks for having this discussion. And that's an interesting take. A lot of, not just with Kamala Harris, but also with a couple of the other candidates looking at the past during these debates.
I think Lenny is representative of what a lot of Democrats are thinking right now. In fact, one of the things that if you look at the two debates, you could say is, boy, there wasn't a lot of mention of Trump. You know, while Trump was mentioned and candidates were often attacking Trump, it was the case that for the most part, they were talking about what they would do. And I think that's what Democrats want to hear right now. Democrats want to hear from the candidates. What are your plans? What ideas do you have? How would you transform this government? And they're not as focused on attacking each other. On the other hand, the problem candidates face in these debates is when you have 10 candidates and you're each looking at fighting for a little bit of time over the course of 2 hours, one of the ways to attract that attention is try to force a moment where you engage another candidate and criticize them, particularly the front runner, because that's likely to get noticed. I do think, though, that Lenny raises an interesting issue, which is something I've been grappling with, which is how far back do you go in these criticisms? One of the problems that Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden and other candidates over time are now going to face is that when you have a record in public service of 10 or 20 or 30 years, you can go back pretty far and find comments or policy positions that are no longer in sync with the political culture. And is it fair to really bring those up and say, well, 30 years ago you thought this? Or is there some way to think about how a candidate evolves over time? And I think for candidates, the resolution to that is being able to explain clearly, here's what I believed then and why I believed it, and here's how I've changed or what I believe now. And I think one of the failings in the debate the other night was probably that in the exchange with Senator Harris, Vice President Biden wasn't as clear as he could be on his position on busing.
Well, we're talking with political science professor, Colby College professor Tony Corrado here on Maine Calling. We're talking about the race for the White House. We are having technical problems. We are unable to take phone calls, but we'd love to have you join the conversation. You can tweet at Maine Calling. You can send a brief email, and do it quickly, please, to talk@mainepublic.org, or you can post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Maine State Music Theater, presenting Treasure Island, June 26th through July 13th. Tickets online at msmt.org.
Coming up on the next Commonwealth Club program, author Julian Guthrie tells the story of four women who, through grit and ingenuity, became stars in the cutthroat, high-stakes, male-dominated world of venture capital in Silicon Valley. On the next Commonwealth Club radio program.
That's coming up in just a few minutes at 2 o'clock right here on the stations of Maine Public Radio. Maine's Political Pulse, our weekly discussion on the politics of our state, with our two top Maine Public News political reporters, Mal Leary and Steve Missler, is now available each week on Friday afternoons at 2, online at mainepublic.org. As for here on the radio, you can hear two versions, a longer version during the 10 o'clock hour of Sunday's weekend edition, and another shorter version Monday morning during morning edition. Maine's Political Pulse, for on-demand listening or as a podcast, is of course always available online at mainepublic.org/politicalpulse, or just click on News.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, The Race for the White House. My guest today, Tony Corrado of Colby College, political scientist and a national expert on campaign finance. We were hoping to have Gene Cummings from The Wall Street Journal, but we have not been able to solve our technical problems. Those same technical problems mean you cannot call and join the conversation, but we'd love to have a quick email from you, talk@mainepublic.org. You can post to our Facebook page or tweet at Maine Calling. Tony, 20 candidates in the Democratic primary. At what point will this field winnow? At what point will we not have 20 anymore? It won't be till the first primary, right?
Well, let's be clear. There are 20 in the debate. There are 25
candidates.
Oh, that's
right. Yes. I'm sorry. Thank you for the correction.
And so we will start to see the winnowing take place, over the course of this summer. We've got the financial reports that are coming out in 2 weeks formally. Those candidates who do well will start announcing their totals before that. And that will be the second indicator after this debate of how candidates are doing. And this will particularly start to give us some idea of which candidates aren't having very much success raising money and therefore are not going to be able to be campaigning as aggressively as others. Certainly, I think after we get to the next set of debates, we'll have a serious winnowing of the field.
And that next set of debates is when?
At the end of July. We've got two more debates, once again scheduled to be two nights if 20 candidates qualify. I expect that we may see a little shakeup in the lineup because there were some candidates who got in late, like Steve Bullock, the governor of Montana, who one would think might qualify for the next debate, or Congressman Sestak of Pennsylvania, who's gotten in a little late. But those debates will be under new rules, extending the rules from the first set of debates so that now a candidate will need at least 2% of the polls and will need 130,000 donors as opposed to 1% and 65,000 donors for the first set of debates. So that will produce some winnowing for candidates who, can't now continue some momentum to reach the higher level of qualification.
So this higher qualification is for the July debates or the ones coming up in the fall?
It's for the July debates.
Oh, okay. So we're likely to see fewer than 20 candidates qualify, you believe?
I would think so. But, one of the interesting things about this first round of debates was that some of the candidates began to make appeals on Facebook and social media and others to try to get the number of donors needed to qualify for the debates, kind of a let me be heard. And it'll be interesting to see if that continues to be the case, because certainly there's interest in the Democratic Party in hearing from a number of these candidates. But I expect we'll start to see a smaller field by the time we get to the end of July.
We have a tweet from Matt. I'm happy that Maine has paper ballots, but in many other states, voting machines are incredibly vulnerable to hacking and vote changing. Evidence is now coming out about vote changes in North Carolina, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, not to mention Georgia.
Election security is an important issue for 2020. And election security involves not just, you know, what you read in the newspapers about, you know, Russian interference or the possible hacking of fake news sites, but it's also the case that there has been a concern for some time now about the simple mechanics of voting machines, the quality of our ability to make sure that every voter can effectively cast their ballot and have it counted. And part of the problem that we face is that a number of states have not kept up with their voting machines. They have not invested in the new equipment, and therefore we have, in many cases, outdated equipment that's running on old technology, old software programs, and therefore, you know, leading to concerns about whether or not they give accurate counts. There's often stories about vote changes that occur because technically it's possible, but at least in the past, all the cases in which this was examined and investigated, it found that it wasn't necessarily the case that the machines were making vote changes, but it was more human error or error in the final counting. That's one of the reasons why so many people believe that it's important to have some kind of a verifiable system for voting machines, where there's some paper trail so that if there's any question, you can go back and do an audit. But I think that this is certainly the type of issue that the Democrats have been concerned about. In fact, in the House, they just passed a bill to address some of these types of issues. But as with any other election security measures, it's being held up in the Senate because Senator McConnell feels that no bill on election security should pass through the Senate, that this should be left to the states. And that's one of the problems we face. We basically have 50 different state systems instead of one national standard and approach.
David on Facebook says, have you already addressed the Supreme Court's gerrymandering decision? Tony Corrado, does the gerrymandering decision affect the Electoral College or only congressional districts?
The gerrymandering decision affects congressional districts. It doesn't really affect the Electoral College. In that regard, the census case that's being debated in the Supreme Court and in the courts is much more important because that's about the vote count of the population, which will determine how many members of the House of Representatives you eventually get. But this Supreme Court gerrymandering decisions are extremely important. In 2010, you know, by some estimates, the gerrymandering that took place was so partisan that the Republicans picked up 15 to 18 seats just by rigging the maps. And consequently, there's been a great focus on the role of partisan gerrymandering. And this Supreme Court decision saying that this is not an issue that we consider justiciable, meaning that this is not a debate to be resolved in the courts, it's a debate to be left to the legislatures, is very important because it seems that we're not going to be able to turn to the Supreme Court to relieve this problem before we have gerrymandering or redistricting in 2021. This is going to make many of the state and local races much more intensive because the state elections are the ones particularly affected because that's where gerrymandering is often most egregious in state legislatures and in setting up partisan state legislatures. And these state elections coming up in a number of states are going to be very important because they're now going to determine which party controls the gerrymandering process. That's why we're going to see, I think, a continued effort based on what we saw in the last election of activists trying to get ballot initiatives on the ballot and other measures in legislatures to move to more independent redistricting commissions, because we're now left with that as the best solution to some of these highly partisan maps.
We have an email from Joe. When the Democratic field eventually starts to thin, do you see the front runners adopting popular policy positions that the rest of the field have put forward thus far?
Well, I think it's the case, Joe, that we're already seeing a number of these candidates adopt popular policy positions within the party. You know, if you think about Bernie Sanders and how in 2016 he was in many ways a lone voice on these progressive issues, what we see now are 5, 6, 7, 8 candidates who are adopting very similar policy issues and are in some ways taking us into the weeds of the details to distinguish themselves from each other. So I do think that policy positions that are popular do eventually get adopted. The reason the Democrats are in a bit of a quandary right now is because of the debate that we started the show with about the different strategies in the party and the question of whether or not a Democratic nominee, for example, if it is a Joe Biden, adopts some of the progressive policies that Bernie Sanders and others have been advocating, or whether a progressive candidate who emerges tends to adopt a more pragmatic approach to try to be more competitive in the general election and avoid the tag of socialism. And so there's going to be some sorting out in the party as to what positions they really want to focus on in the general election.
All right. Tom on Facebook asks, interested in any thoughts on how the presidential general election will impact the Maine Senate race and vice versa? Will this make Maine a battleground state?
I think that Maine is going to be a battleground state, particularly because of the Senate election. The Senate election here in Maine is going to be one of the most highly focused and nationally covered elections that we've ever seen in the state of Maine. The reelection campaign for Susan Collins is going to draw national attention. It's going to bring a lot of money into the state. I think it's going to be a very competitive race. And that is going to be compounded by the fact that we have a presidential year where Maine will be seen as an important state, not only because of the fact that we're going to have, I expect, much higher turnout because of the Senate race, but also because of the fact that Maine's allocation of its districts, where we give one electoral college vote for each of the congressional districts, is going to bring a lot of focus to the second district in Maine.
Sure, that's why Donald Trump came to Bangor several times.
That's exactly right, and I think we're going to see more of that in 2020 because with a very competitive Senate race where Susan Collins tends to do well in the second district, I think that those on the presidential election are going to see that as an opportunity.
An email from Charles, should Biden falter? Is it still possible for Michael Bloomberg to secure the Democratic Party's presidential nomination?
I think that Mr. Bloomberg looked at the prospects of pursuing the nomination as a Democrat and decided not to. He also looked at the prospects of running as an independent and decided not to. In large part because the hurdles facing an independent are so difficult with getting on the ballot and being able to mount an independent campaign, he decided that focusing on the issues of concern to him, like gun control, was a better way to pursue his political advocacy. And I think that the mechanics of the Democratic nomination race are such that there's still room for someone to get in. There's still a number of months where someone could get in and still, meet all of the requirements. So the opportunity still exists. I just think that Mr. Bloomberg would be happy with some of the options that the Democrats are offering. So there's no reason for him to jump into the race to see the kinds of issues he would like to discuss.
Are there any other names being floated? Anybody who actually might jump in at this point?
I think at this point, about everyone who wanted to get into the swimming pool has gotten into the swimming pool. 25
is a full swimming pool. An email from Ellen. Why do analysts talk as though 2020 will be a repeat of 2016, as in, quote, Democrats need to win 70,000 more votes in the Rust Belt? Isn't 2020 a new ball game given the blue wave in 2018 and all we have witnessed about Trump since 2016? And Tony, Ellen is going to the, what did we used to call it, the $40,000 question?
Yeah, this is now becoming the $100,000 question. Ellen, you're raising the question that Democrats are grappling with right now. And I think that, there's a lot to be said for the prospects coming out of 2018 of the mobilization of younger voters, women, and minorities, given how polarizing Trump is, to turn them out in ever greater numbers, and that this is a key for the Democrats. There will be a focus on these Midwestern states that are traditional Democratic states and traditional Democrats who voted for Obama and then shifted to Trump, in large part because most election analysts base their analyses of the next election based on what happened in the past. And in some ways, there is a debate within the Democratic Party about whether this time will be different. And many of those who are analysts tend to err on the side of this time won't be different. It always tends to be the same, where others are saying, no, there's a real generational shift taking place and a shift in the thinking of Americans about the issues facing the country that may make 2020 different.
As we watch this all unfold, Tony Corrado, what are some of the issues emerging in the Democratic race that you're paying particular attention to?
Well, there is a real debate about health care. And in particular, as you know, many of the candidates are talking about some form of Medicare for all, some way to get coverage for all Americans. But there are real differences amongst the candidates as to whether or not this type of an approach should include undocumented immigrants, whether or not private insurance should be eliminated or be continued. There is a real debate amongst the Democrats about what our best approach should be to immigration policy and student loan debt, which is particularly important for younger voters, where, you know, there's a real question as to should there be just some government relief, or should we go to the plan of Elizabeth Warren and just eliminate the student debt entirely? Should it only be for middle class students? Should it also include the wealthy? So there are real policy differences, even amongst the progressive candidates. And I think the one place where many voters are waiting to hear what they have to say is on issues like climate change and foreign policy, since we still haven't heard a lot about that.
Well, Tony Corrado, professor at Colby College, I'm so sorry about the technical problems, but if we're going to have them, you are the guest to have on Maine Calling. And thank you to our audience for rolling with it today. Anthony Corrado, professor of government at Colby College, a campaign finance expert. Nikki Shields ran the board today. Ella Boyd answered your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as helpful links and resources at mainecalling.org. Today's show will be broadcast again tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.